Get in, losers. We are watching It. Welcome to Derry, episode 3. Now you see it. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we're going to go through this brand new episode. There's lots to go over in this one. It seems like each episode so far has been really good about giving us some stuff to talk about, which I appreciate. But I think before we dive into the meat of this, we should talk about some numbers that came out. I don't know if you've noticed some of those little numbers. Apparently, people are liking the show. Have you seen the reports?
I saw it did really well, but I don't know what the final stats are. I know like it was tracking like the first 3 days, it was so many millions, but do you have the specific?
I do. I got the full numbers. HBO reports.
Hit us with the stats.
Yeah, HBO reports 5.7 million viewers over the first 3 days of launch, which puts it only behind House of the Dragon and The Last of Us and for those 3 days. Now, obviously, we'll see what the numbers are as the show continues on. There's lots of curiosity and interest. But I think that what, to me, this goes to show is that it is still such a powerful pop culture presence, right? People fucking love Pennywise. They just do. And there's a curiosity about it, which is a good thing because that curiosity is starting to get paid off. If you've been a little impatient, in this episode, we finally start seeing little glimpses of our boys. So, yeah.
Do you think people were impatient for the clown, like that they don't get the clown right away in the first two episodes? I saw a little bit of that, like complaining online about not getting Pennywise, that it's too much about the kids, too much about Halloran. But I don't agree with that, and I think those people are crazy if they think that Pennywise is going to be the main character. Like, are we going to just see Pennywise hanging out in his lair, waking up? Ooh, it's been a long 27 years. Could go for a snack. I wonder if there's any kids about.
It reminds me of that Rick and Morty episode where they had the Freddy Krueger stand-in. Do you ever see that? And he just goes home.
No.
and his burnt wife and his burnt kids are like just always on him about like, oh, you don't bring that, because he's like, bitch, give me this. And he's like, they're like, no, that stays at work. You don't bring that home.
And the anger.
Freddy anger. Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, it's like, what are the daily lives of these monsters? Yes, I do think. I think also joined by my cat. Hello. I do think that that there is some impatience with it because people want to see Pennywise. And you know, you can't blame them. The show's called It. Welcome to Derry. The advertising's all Pennywise all the time. Silhouettes everywhere. I get it. But I think the only way that this doesn't work out well for the Muschiettis and the showrunners, Jason Fuchs and everything, is if they cheap out on the back half. If they don't deliver Pennywise, then in full Pennywise glory, because you have to remember that the movies, the books, like Pennywise isn't the front and center either in the King book or the movies. I think that the screen time of Pennywise in the first movie is got to be less than 20 minutes, 15 minutes maybe, right? So Pennywise has always been the threat that looms over everything. But yes, I do sense a little bit of impatience, but I think that the only time that's going to matter is if they don't pay him off at the end of the season.
And I think it's, without spoiling anything, you will get a payoff. Trust me, Pennywise is coming. Yeah. That should be our headline for this show. Pennywise is coming. We're getting a little glimpse of him in this. But, you know, I think it's so important to establish that it is not Pennywise.
Right.
Exclusively. Right. That this isn't a killer clown. This is a shape-shifting entity that occasionally takes the form of the clown. And why does it like the form of the clown? That is what this first season is going to answer for people.
Right.
And I think it's important for these first few episodes for Pennywise to not take that shape. And we do see a very weird little clown. Pennywise-esque, I'd say, right, in the background, in the opening of this of episode 3, where a young boy is, we're told right away, it's 1908, which immediately for me set off an alarm, like, okay, that's the year the Kitchener Ironworks exploded. Mm-hmm. And so that tells us, okay, we already know that's part of Derry's lore. That's sort of the culmination of Pennywise. There's always sort of a cataclysm. There's a horrible death that kicks off Pennywise's arrival, and then a terrible cataclysm that ends Pennywise's reign. And we know that that is coming. We see that teased in the incredible postcard opening sequence. We see the bunny, the Easter bunny on fire, flying through the air, the kids flying through the air, the Easter eggs on fire, that this factory is going to blow, and it's going to blow during like a big family holiday event. That's not, that's a spoiler, but it's well known in the book, and in the Muschietti's, they told us, and they've been public about this, that the that Welcome to Derry is going to be three seasons. This one is about the Black Spot. This one, the next one is about the Bradley Gang, which is like a Bonnie and Clyde type group of thieves who meet a bad end in Derry. And then the next one is going back further in time to the Kitchener Ironworks. But we get this flashback to 1908 and a boy walking through a very Ray Bradbury-esque carnival.
Right.
And he sees what in the background? We only see it twice.
You see it, well, and this is done so well, by the way. So you see kind of an over-the-shoulder look where you see familiar frills, the fluffy clown suit. You see kind of the right colorization in the background. And then towards the end of this sequence at the beginning, you get a really good look at this clown. I'm not. It looked like it was a woman. It looked to me, but she's got the white face, the big red smile that does the little curl up past the eyes. You know, I have a feeling like that this is going to prove to be, you know, the origins of the look for Pennywise, and I'm not saying this as somebody who's like seen that already come to pass. This is me theorizing because I've only seen ahead to this next coming episode, and then everything else for the rest of the season is super fresh for me as we're going through. But it is so clearly that's the Pennywise design that the Muschietti's went with, down to the frills and the face makeup. So
it's interesting. I don't want to say too much because I know a little more. I've seen ahead a little further. And, yes, I will say this character is extremely important and I would urge people to watch episode 3 a couple of times because the character is there more than you realize, let's say.
Interesting. Well, I did notice that there's a bookend, which I think is really interesting. It starts with a clown. Well, one, the title of this episode is Now You See It.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that for a little bit. I noticed that the episode's kind of bookended with the clowns. Right, so you have the clown introduction, the familiar clown that we know of is the kind of Pennywise design, and then the very final image is a photo that is taken by our ragtag group of surviving kids, the fighters, showing a clown, very familiar-looking clown. And so you kind of have it bookended. That didn't escape me. I don't know if that, you know, I was going to say, I don't know if it's intentional. I'm sure it was intentional. It had to be intentional to have the final scene and the opening scene kind of mirror each other in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so. But I love it. I can't wait for more to come out. But yeah, that little clown, and it's not quite the same as the Pennywise design. You're right. There are the sort of curly Q elements. They're like the aesthetics of Pennywise.
Right.
But it's not a mirror image, and there's more to come.
Interesting.
Like this carnival was cool. Very malevolent seeming carnival.
Well, are there any carnivals that aren't malevolent? I mean, have you ever been to a carnival that didn't like make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up in some way? There's something. I love carnivals. Don't get me wrong. Fall carnivals especially, but man, there's something like dangerous and greasy and weird. Like I'm a roller coaster guy. Like I love going to theme parks. You will never see me on a carnival roller coaster. I will never.
You don't trust those bolts, carny installed bolts.
Are you the little vomit rockets? No, sir. Not for me. I'm not. That's not my idea of a good time to trust. These traveling bands of people that are, I don't know, trying to get you to throw balls and at milk cartons and stuff. Yeah.
Did you catch the cameo at the carnival?
The piano player? Is this who you're talking
about? The piano player, yeah.
I did.
Don't shoot the piano player. He's our director, Andy Muschietti.
Yeah. Yeah, he gives himself a little love there. I will say there's a few good close-ups he gets as he's smoking his cigar and ushering in.
Move along, kid.
Yeah. He gets a line. I mean, so you know he got some SAG day rate there. So look at that guy. He needs more money. That's what's happening. He needed another it check, I think. Mm-hmm. No, I noticed that. I noticed even before you go into the kind of the freak show element of it, did you notice that one of the carnival games was throwing baseballs at you at one of two things? It was either clowns. The stuffed clowns or a stuffed turtle.
What was the other?
The other one was turtles.
Oh, right.
So, which one, you know, we mentioned in the, I think our very first episode of this talked about how in the book, the turtle Maturin is, you know, kind of shown as the antithesis of Pennywise. This is the force of light that maybe is giving power to these kids to fight. It's very ambiguous, but you know, it's definitely set up. If you have Pennywise, he is the devil on one shoulder, Maturin the turtle is the angel on the other, right? So
I don't like to think of this turtle thing as the antithesis. I'm not quarreling with your language there, but it really isn't quite the antithesis because Pennywise, this malignant entity, is very active.
Right.
In our world, and interfering and fucking people up. And the turtle, if it's a stand-in for God, this is an absentee God in a lot of ways, who doesn't, it's not like it's actively trying to defeat Pennywise. It like interferes sometimes, it helps sometimes, it doesn't help other times. Very Judeo-Christian, if I'm being honest.
Yes, like, cherry-picking its moments, right?
Like Lord, like, you know, it's very Job-like. Like, why are you turtle God? Why are you not helping me? I believe in you. Like, why are you not helping me? And, you know, the turtle doesn't step in an active role. It's almost like it'll help you in a critical moment. It'll provide little clues. But it's a very hands-off kind of being. So it's benevolent, yes, in that it's not trying to cause harm. But it's not really trying to rectify this situation either.
It's not a fighter.
It's not in any final
It's
way.
An establishment Democrat is what we're talking about.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not, it's not fighting, but it's, you know, its intentions are good, I guess.
It's Joe Manchin is the turtle of the Senate.
Well, let's
not
go that far. But it's I might be getting my Stephen King confused. I don't remember if it's in It or if this is a Dark Tower thing where I think it might be Dark Tower where they go to try to like actually find the turtle and they find its corpse and that the turtle's actually dead and the god is dead and it's like the remaining powers of this thing that's just kind of out there. So maybe that's why it's not active, or maybe I'm just mixing that up with some other weird multi-dimensional Stephen King weirdness from one of his books. But
yeah, I think that's in the Dark Tower. But yeah, yeah, I just don't think that it's not like Pennywise is so clever and so shrewd, and the turtle is like, oh, hey kids, you need some help, like
you got some power. Here's a bicycle. Here's a slingshot. You know,
It reminds me a little of that. You know, Stephen King himself retold the story of Job from the Bible. I think I'm trying to remember which book it was. It might even have been in. It's not Sleepwalkers. Could it have been in Storm of the Century when a character is like explaining, basically summarizing Job, and it's like all these bad things happen to Job, but Job is so faithful, keeps being faithful in God, keeps worshiping God, keeps believing in him, but begs him one day, God, why, if I've been such a good servant and loyal servant to you, why have you smote me in so many painful ways? And God replies, Job, there's just something about you that pisses me off. Which is a very... I would love to... You know, if Steve is looking for new projects, I would love to read the Stephen King interpretation of the Bible, where you just... Stephen King retells the Bible with all sorts of main aphorisms.
His folksy language, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know, Job. There's just something about you that pisses me off.
That's so very Stephen King. I love it. And also, before we get into the freak show tent that kind of kicks off the fears of this main kid that we're following for, and we don't know who it is right at the beginning. Maybe I'm crazy, but the carnival barker was somebody in makeup, and I'm pretty sure that was James Remar. Did you catch that?
It kind of looked like him. It looked really familiar, but I think it's a different actor.
You think so? Yeah, but for whatever reason, they put it in makeup, and if my... Maybe my gut was pushing me to that. If it's not James Remar. James Remar plays the general, right? The General Shaw, mm-hmm. And he's we come to find out that this little boy is him as a child, and this is kind of his connection to Derry and his first run-in with the monster. And so I thought that if that was Remar in makeup, then that would have been a clever way to tie the actor that we've seen play this character for the first couple episodes to his childhood self. If it's not, then it's, you know, it's just odd that they put a guy under some very, you know, clear prosthetics for this character. It works either way because carnival barkers are creepy dudes anyway. So
it's they're not sending their best to that. Right. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where you're definitely attracting a particular kind of character, let's say. But I wondered when did you detect that this was General Shaw as a boy, because it doesn't announce itself right away. Yeah. And frankly, Welcome to Derry has primed us that when we see a new kid that again, to keep with the carnival theme, this is a carnival goldfish in a sense. It might last 10 years, it might last 2 hours. You don't know that this kid is going to last, right? He could be a Star Trek red shirt who gets dispatched pretty early, and he came close to it. He wins a slingshot in one of the carnival games, and he gives it in trade to a native girl who's selling water along the side of the road,
right?
So he and his dad can get a drink. He doesn't have quite enough pennies. So he supplements that with the slingshot, and thank God he does, because she uses the slingshot to save his ass. We don't know that he's even saved at the very beginning, because this prologue ends with it chasing after him in the form of an emaciated man that he sees in the shadows in the freak tent.
Right.
And can we just pause on the freak show for a moment? Because I thought this was handled really well. It was super creepy and scary. But the thing that makes it scary is not the freaks, but the fact that these are all people with, like, severe medical problems.
Right.
Other than, like it wasn't just, like, oh, the bearded lady and, like, the, I don't know, what are some other common freak show, like the strong man or something like that. It was like, oh, there are these conjoined twins, but they're like conjoined through their intestines, which is a real thing that can happen and can be really hard to separate out. You know, that was pretty sad. Then there's the scrawny man in the shadows who, I don't know, it could be somebody that has a disorder like Marfan syndrome, which is I think they believe Abraham Lincoln had that, and there have been actors who have this. It makes you very tall. It makes your face very thin. It also creates some medical problems with your organs that turn up later. So, like, you could see these people in the tent, and it's just like, oh, like they're just people who probably should get regular medical care rather than be held up as oddities, but. Also, you feel for these kinds of individuals because they're probably, this is how you make money if you're perhaps ill and not able to work. Like if you're conjoined twins with a shared intestine, I don't know that there's a whole lot of work you can do. Certainly not separate work. You know, you're sort of tethered together, literally.
Yeah. I mean,
it captured the sadness.
Yeah, that's exactly what the freak shows were. I mean, you can see that going back to Todd Browning's film. You know, it's the freaks. They were you know, sold as the horror to bring the audiences in, but they're the heroes of the movie. I mean, they're the ones that are you know, they take their revenge, but they're more like revolting workers and not, you know, monsters trying to, kill good and decent working, you know, God-fearing Christians, right? It's, I mean, that's how it was. And I thought that was very smart. And it was also, once again, a way to establish the fear that this child felt. He was terrified of that gaunt man. So what does it show up to him as when he's in his domain? the Gaunt Man.
Yep.
You know, it's once like again, mm-hmm. you know, showing us, you know, this goes back to the lampshade sequence that we were talking about. It's like when you tell kids hold on to things, mm-hmm. they're the freshest when they experience them right away, mm-hmm. right? So that's why they have nightmares. I remember I showed my nephews The Sixth Sense, and the youngest one apparently had nightmares about one single image from that, and that's the little boy who Haley Joel Osment sees, is like the tween boy that's like, hey, I know where my dad hides his gun, and he turns around and the back of his head's gone. Apparently he had nightmares about the boy with the bloody head after that, and I'm sure that lasted for a couple of days, and then he probably never thought of it again. And I would assume that for Francis, this child, he mm-hmm. probably give him a week and he wouldn't think about that guy again, but it was fresh, and the entity behind Pennywise, knows this and uses it to its full horrific ends, right? So
mm-hmm. So
I thought it was special. And to answer your question from earlier, I didn't clock that this was the general really until they flash forwarded a little bit. But yeah, I was with you. I thought this was the sacrifice. It's like, hey, we got to kill a kid at the beginning of every episode, right? Let's do this.
Well, it was interesting when he, so again, skipping forward a little bit, midway through the episode, General Shaw is, you know, they're studying the remains of this Model T car they've pulled from mm-hmm. the mud that is a remnant of the Bradley gang. And so he's doing the Mike Hanlon work of researching what is this creature, right? That's why, you know, in last week's episode, you were saying like this whole military aspect wasn't working for you. I'm curious whether it's working better for you now, because I really like that, the notion that like, okay, Mike Hanlon's not the first person to try to study this thing, you know?
Right.
And the military through General Shaw, like suddenly when this happened, I thought, oh, that's cool that he was the boy and that's how he knows this thing is here. And now when he returns to Derry, it awakens this memory, just as it does for everybody who goes away and comes back. You forget about it when you leave, you recall the creature when you return,
right.
And he's like, oh shit, there's this thing here, like, let's figure out what that is. And so he's studying the cars, he's using Halloran's psychic abilities, right. He calls him a human compass at one point,
right,
to find out what this thing is. And he doesn't know. He's not like, you know, there's a clown, it's this killer clown that's a ghost or a supernatural. He doesn't have a theory of the thing,
right.
He just has this notion that it creates fear, it thrives on fear. That's why he likes Leroy Hanlon, because he has this war wound that I guess has stifled his amygdala, so he's not able to feel fear.
Right.
And you know, they talk about the Bradley gang, and one of his deputies is like, yeah, you know, people saw the entity in one of its forms.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion that there's this thing, he's not quite sure what it is, but he's trying to get to the bottom of it. I really love that. So how does the military aspect work for you now? Now that you know that's how Uncle Sam found out about Pennywise.
It's way more interesting to me now, for sure. I think there's a moment where he goes and reunites with Rose, who was his friend growing up. It was the native girl he bought the water from, the one who saved him with the very slingshot he traded for the water. And he explains, he's just like, I'd completely forgotten about you. I'd forgotten about my experiences as a child here. And like, to me, that's interesting. I kind of wish we would have seen it. Maybe we will later on in another flashback, of the idea of this guy just being stationed in this town, you know, coming back home. He's like, and he has a memory of like, oh yeah, I grew up there or whatever. And he's stationed there. And the second he's there, the things come flooding back into him, and it was mine. Yeah. And
can I just jump in quickly with a filmmaking praise that the dissolve when they show the young native girl.
Right.
And then it sort of dissolves into the present day, and you see secondhand Rose as an older woman.
Right.
I thought that was magnificent, and I'm like, damn, they great casting too, because
totally.
The kid actor looks just like her.
Totally.
Like, I'm like, is this her daughter or granddaughter
yeah,
or something?
Be, yeah.
Like she looks so similar.
Yeah, and
I thought that was a great little. fade.
Well, and I also like that even in just this, like, you only get a few minutes of them kind of palling around together, right, as kids. Mm-hmm. But you already, you see the echoes of the kids in the 60s and their team dynamic and them protecting each other. Mm-hmm. You see echoes of the losers club, you know, already, and you just see how it always comes down to kids looking out for each other. And to the point, like, whenever she saves him from it in the woods, when she shoots him with a slingshot, what happens? The blood slowly floats up, just like it does when Bev saves Eddie and everybody in the Niebolt house. And it, you know, it is mm-hmm. it is the real sign of wounding this creature, is these kids, you know, throwing their fear out the window and standing up to it. And it's always represented with that floaty wound stuff. You've seen, you know, the image of Pennywise get hurt in a million different ways, and he just, like, cracks and shrugs it off. But it's only when, you know, through just, like, pure strength of will and friendship, like, does suddenly it hurt, and you can tell
that
it's
symbolic power too,
right?
You know, in it, in the losers prime group, there's you know, they use the silver dollars that they melt down into bullets, and they figure if it takes the werewolf form, it has to live. It has, the great revelation of it is it has to abide by its own rules, that it, if it takes the form of something, it must follow the rules of that thing's vulnerabilities. And the notion that it's wounded seems to be exacerbated by the belief and the friendship and the bond. There's like a goodness and a decency in that slingshot. He trades it to her for the water. If he hadn't done that, say he had tried to say, well, we don't have this, we're just going to take the water anyway and make his way off, she wouldn't have had the slingshot to save his life later.
Right.
And, you know, when he pulls the little cigar box out of – when an adult General Shaw pulls the cigar box out and says, like, let's give this to Halloran. This thing wounded – the entity once upon a time. My wife, she was like, it's going to be the slingshot. And she was right. Yeah. It's the slingshot. And then Halloran is using the shine that he has to touch the slingshot and sort of try to connect with this being as he hovers over Derry in a Leroy Hanlon piloted chopper.
is a great sequence, because this is probably my favorite part of this episode. Is watching Dick Halloran do his thing, and watching the look and the way Chris Chalk plays this, by the way, is so good. You're getting that moment, because in the last time we talked about the show and for episode two, I was mentioning how Chris on the red carpet said that, you know, that the in for his character here was like, what does this guy who's always been ahead of the curve and on everything because of his shine powers, what does he do when he meets an entity like Pennywise, when he stumbles upon him? And the way he plays it here is so good, as he's getting not only glimpses, but he finds himself in Pennywise's lair. And I guess this is the first time we really hear Bill Skarsgård as well, as Pennywise's little traveling, whatever, his little puppet theater that he's got there, opens up, and you kind of, you see his eyes and you hear him say, who are you? And the way that Chalk plays this, it's so good. And just, it's not direct fear, but like this kind of befuddlement of like, wait a minute, there's some other, like, crazy power here. The beyond
loss of control,
exactly. And he's, you know, like, listen, I love it because it's also, we get to see Pennywise's lair again. You get to, you know, see the floating dead kids and all that stuff, which is very familiar. It's a little nostalgic already, and that's great. But to me, it was the way that Halloran responds to this thing and the way he acts afterwards, by the way, when he's just like, it's like, you found, and he's like, it saw me. I didn't see it. And it's like, maybe we should leave this fucking thing alone. You know, I love it. It's a little humility is struck into this character.
It also leaves some room for the audience to project, like, okay, this guy, we know he's like from the bayou, right? He's from Louisiana. That's a very spiritual place. There are a lot of legends and ghosts and tales. And you got to imagine a guy with a shine, a young boy with a shine growing up there, is seeing a lot of things, just like Danny is seeing those images in a in the hotel, right? So this is a guy who's encountered supernatural entities before, but for the first time, you're right, he looks at this one and he's like, whoa, like, wait, hold on. This isn't just a haint, you know what I mean? Like, this is a fucking, like, some other kind of thing. And it's got a stack of bodies, you know, that's as tall as a skyscraper in this underground cistern that are floating around. And then one of them comes and zooms down on him, and it's his grandmother.
Yeah.
Now, what do you make of this? Is this Pennywise creating an image? Is Pennywise reading him and creating a sense? But the old lady gives him a warning.
Yeah.
Or is this actually Grandma?
You know, I think it can be read both ways. It's really interesting because she's not shown as really something scary other than the fact that she's floating and flying, right?
Yeah.
She doesn't look well, but she doesn't look like... It's not like the mother from the second episode, right? Where you're like, God damn, this is meant to strike fear. But also, it has warned potential threats before, right? Or as maybe not in the timeline of here. This is before the events of the book and the other movies. But, you know, he's afraid of the losers coming back into town, and he tries to warn them away and says, you know, you'll die if you try, get away, you know, don't even try, you know, I'll kill you all, blah, blah, blah. But that's like, that's not what Pennywise does when they're kids. Like, he's just trying to get them out. He's actually scared of them. I think Pennywise is kind of scared of Halloran, or at least I think he might view Halloran as a threat. The fact that he doesn't immediately try to intimidate Halloran, he just goes, who are you? And he sees him and he marks him. There's something different about this guy, especially as an adult, being able to, you know, force his way into psychically force his way into Pennywise's, you know, lair.
Well, I think it's a lack of control for Pennywise, too, because Pennywise, like, we're using Pennywise and it interchangeably here, but it is used to deciding when you see it, right? It's invisible most of the time, but when it wants to be seen, it controls the levers on that. And this time, it doesn't.
Right.
And so I think it's a sort of startle reaction. It's like wandering into a cave and there's a bear.
Yeah.
like,
who are you?
You know, that
you
bear might not be... might not be afraid of you, but it is kind of like a, what are you doing here? And I think you're right about the grandma. I don't think grandma is a manifestation of Pennywise. I think that is the spirit of his grandma stepping in to say, I think grandma comes back when she wants to warn her grandchild. I think they have a deep connection. And I love that she's a Stephen King classic character. She is from The Shining as well. Like, he talks about his grandmother giving him the terms to understand this power that he has. She's the one who coins the term The Shine.
Right.
So,
and
you know, that's her.
And it tracks, I guess, if you're looking at, like, what King does with Dr. Sleep, what Flanagan ended up, you know, really leaning into in his adaptation. You know, having Halloran appear to young Danny and whatever. Now, I know in the book, my memory of the book is a little vague. I haven't read it since it came out. But Halloran was still alive at the end of The Shining book. And he, I believe all the interactions he has with Danny at the beginning are just him in person, because they're all alive and they're kind of hanging together.
He helps him pass. So there's a scene where Danny sort of eases his journey. Uses his power to help Halloran let go.
Can you refresh him? Does Halloran reply return to him in the way that he does in the adaptation?
I think he does, but not in the overt, like, I'm standing here. Like, on film, you need that character to appear, like, on screen. So I don't know that it's I'm not my memory's not fresh enough to say for sure, but I think it's more, you know, King likes to have recurring themes, like a phrase or a reminder that comes about, like, hey ho, let's go from Pet Sematary, kind of keeps popping up. Like, it's this little sort of like almost like a mantra, you know. And but most of his interactions with Halloran are when Halloran is just an old man, and I think that's a bit of a defiant Steve move too, like, fuck you, you can't put an axe into my character. He lives.
I told you he lives.
He did get his teeth knocked out. He gets his teeth
because it's
knocked
got the croak
by,
mouth, right?
by the croak mallet. So he did get hurt in that return, but he lives.
He also has one of the best moments that, like, it's one of those things I always forget it, and I've read The Shining 4 times probably at this point, mm-hmm. you know, cover to cover. And I always forget this moment. You know, maybe I won't next time because I keep harping on it, but I love there's a moment at the very end of the book where Danny and Wendy, they're going to leave. And they're going to leave, and Halloran's there with them, and he's hurt. And he's tempted one more time by the hotel. And for a second, it almost gets him. Right, like the hotel almost convinces, like, I think he's even got a weapon that he's going to go and try to kill them with. And I love that he has that one final moment. Anyway, that's a Stephen King stuff. That's nothing to do with it, but I mean, tangentially it does. But my whole point of mm-hmm. talking about this was that I think that it's established that you do have the people with the shine can hang around and help out the people later. So I think you could read it both ways. I don't know which side of the fence I fall on. I don't know if that's his grandmother actively trying to warn him from the other side, or if that's
it's like you're a force ghost.
Yeah, it could be a force ghost, or it could be it, you know, just trying to scare him off and go, you know, this is it could be a manifestation of it, but not in a I'm going to terrify you to get away, and more of a, you know, I'm going to use this to try to make you feel like you're being warned from the other side. I could be read either way.
I feel like, I mean, you're right. It could be read, and that's part of the fun of it and part of the fun of a show like this, right? That we can debate what it means. But I think Pennywise is still doing the download. You know, in those spy movies when it's like, you've got to upload this to this little device that we put on the computer, and like, they're at the glamorous Euro party and they got to get out of there, and it's like 78%. 79%, 80%, and like, you know, the it's basically a countdown. I feel like Pennywise is still doing that to Halloran when Grandma appears. Like, he's still downloading Halloran.
Yeah.
And so Grandma's there like, hey, son, like,
this is your moment. Like, well, and he's still in his trying to escape. He almost throws himself out of a damn, you know, helicopter.
Well, that to me, that's when Pennywise has him. Like, I'm going to make this guy freak out, and he's going to start opening this valve. And and it turns out in reality, Halloran's almost like sleepwalking because he's turning the door, trying to open the back hatch of this helicopter and potentially plummet to his death. So I feel like at that point, Pennywise is fucking with this guy. But I love that scene. I'm glad you did too.
Yeah.
And to go back to the return to the slingshot in General Shaw. Mm. I kept wondering, like, well, how does General Shaw have the slingshot? Like, what's the story there? Mm-hmm. And then we get that answered in the very next scene. My wife, I got to give her credit. She predicted it. Yeah. She's like, I think General Shaw is the boy. So she is very astute about those things. And it wasn't until he walked into the store, into Secondhand Rose, to meet his old friend. And you find out, you get it confirmed. And I'm like, okay, that is cool. That is pretty cool. And I love the... I actually think they did a great job with the characterization of General Shaw.
Yeah.
This guy could be a real cookie cutter.
Yeah.
He could be a racist, headstrong, General Patton type blowhard where, yes, he's skilled in some ways, but he's also just ready for the fight. He could just be a sort of mad dog, you know? And instead, it's like, no, he has this sweet friendship with this Native girl, and whatever their cultural differences don't matter. I love that it, like, even back then in 1908, he wasn't like, ooh, I can't hang with you because I'm white and you're Native. It's I like that there was a sincerity to their friendship, maybe even a little bit of puppy love. I mean, they were just kids then, but as adults, I don't know if you've ever encountered somebody as a grown up that you maybe had a crush on.
Oh, yeah.
Elementary school, and like, there's something so sweet about that.
Oh yeah,
even it's like that's a long ago thing, but it's there's a warmth and a nostalgia and a wholesomeness to that, and I felt that wholesomeness between these two actors and these performances.
Yeah, it's very cute. I definitely have one, and I found her via Facebook back, you know, before Facebook was nothing but AI slop and racist memes. But it was just one of those things. And she had a very unique name, or she still has it, I guess. Her name's Ailette, and she's this Israeli girl that I went to school with, and I remember. You know, it was a crush, but it was like, you know, fifth grade crush, right? So where the pinnacle of being boyfriend, girlfriend meant you held hands, you know? And so And so, like, I found her. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, hey, just, I don't know if you have any idea who I am. And she responded going, oh, my God, I think you were my first boyfriend. She's like, what's going on? It's not like we reconnected or anything, but I thought,
no,
but it is,
but
there is something very uniquely sweet about that. And you're right that this does capture it. And I like the way that this guy is painted for sure. You know, I think casting somebody like James Remar, who can be more of a tough badass, I think most people probably know him. Most people like that are younger maybe know him as Dexter's father, right? He played Dexter's dad that's always talking to him and trying to guide his son's dark impulses or whatever, the dead father or whatever, right?
He was a good guy in that too. I mean, dad was trying to hone his, direct his dark side.
He's,
right?
He's trying towards to help something. but he's, you know, he's a little bit more gruff, and when you cast somebody like this in that role, that's kind of what I expected. And so I'm really happy that they're working against type there. But we should probably talk a little bit. We have two other.
He's played a lot of villains too. Wasn't he a villain in like 48 Hours?
Oh yeah, he's a really good bad guy. Yeah, he was almost Hicks in Aliens as well. Michael Biehn ended up taking over the role for him. Apparently he had a little bit of a drug problem back then. But that stopped him from maybe being as huge of a name as he could have been, but he's a great actor. So I'm glad that he's having this kind of later career resurgence.
There's something about the face of a guy like that too. He looks like someone who is not going to be patient with you. He looks like kind of a fearsome dude. And when he shows warmth and vulnerability, as he does with Secondhand Rose, I know her name is just Rose, but like, I kind of like Secondhand Rose is a cool, like, that's like a cool superhero name.
It's like a Neil Diamond song.
Yeah, exactly, right?
But I
love the warmth that he shows. Right. And like, it's kind of cool that this hard-nosed looking guy has this soft side, you know, and that they're at odds. She's like, why are you guys digging out in the woods? And he's like, we're trying to understand this. And I love that they're like kind of on opposite sides of this, but they're not enemies.
Right.
She's like just trying to say, like, I don't think she really understands what it is either, what it is.
Right.
She knows a little more than he does just by nature of the legends she's heard through her people and tribe, and also being a longtime, lifelong resident of Derry. Right. I think she's just like, yeah, you've got to stay away from this.
Yeah.
She knows what Halloran now knows, which is like, you don't fuck around with the infinite, which is a line from Mean Streets that Steve put as the epigram to it. That's like one of the first. It's that. It's like, you don't fuck around with the infinite from Mean Streets and Born Down in a Dead Man's Town by Bruce Springsteen. Right. Those are the two epigrams that lead off it. And I love both of them. Don't fuck around with the infinite, man.
Well, there's one other thing that I want to touch on for this storyline, because we have three storylines going on in this episode, and we're harping a lot on the military stuff, but, you know, there's lots of revelations. I mean, that's kind of, again, the anchor for this episode. One thing that I noticed that I think is a really deft move here is that they're tying the creation of the Black Spot into Pennywise directly, it directly, by having it be a reward offered by Shaw. Like, what do you guys need? You did so good out there, Dick Halloran. You found this thing. You've made such progress. What can I do for you? And his answer is set up here, where they need a spot for the servicemen of color, you know, to hang out, that's not going to get them in trouble with the local townspeople and make them... Yeah.
It's been set up beautifully, because in the previous episode, remember, Dick and the guys are out at a bar, and Dick's like, "Uh-oh, time to go." Like, he senses
there's no
it's
spot,
time for us
there's
to
no
get
place
out of
for them, so they need their own.
There's
place.
No place there. Here you see them hanging out, playing cards in a tent, and it's raining and it's dripping. And it's obviously not comfortable,
right?
And so, like, Dick asks, like, "Can you give us a place to hang?
Yeah,
place to just be ourselves and lay low and blow off steam." And you're right. Yeah, it's sort of a self-perpetuating thing that if Dick wasn't there in town to look for Pennywise, then maybe the Black Spot would never be created. So.
Yep. And, you know, the fact that it, you know, I mean, I'm not 100% sure, obviously, how the Muschiettis are going to approach it. But, you know, the way that it is in the lore, the black spot doesn't have a happy ending, and the fact that its birth is tied to what will ultimately help kill it is really interesting to me. So, and I think that's very deft writing. It's something that's very, very subtle and doesn't call attention to itself. But it's always directly tied to Pennywise. In this one, it's directly tied to Halloran making that first contact, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. but I think this is a great Halloran episode. Yeah. And if I could include a little self plug, I have a Q&A with Chris Chalk coming up on Esquire.com as part of the episode 3, because I wanted to talk to him about playing this character, and this is a great episode for him. You see him in episode 1, you get his name and a little, you realize who he is in episode 2, but this one you really see who he is. He has this vision in the helicopter, and then there's a great sequence where he visits the Hanlon home, he meets Taylor Page's mm-hmm. character, he breaks bread with Jovan Adepo's Leroy Hanlon. And I think Chalk gives a great performance, because you see Halloran changing his demeanor. He's one way with the guys, mm-hmm. his fellow black service members. He's very buttoned down when he's talking to the general. He's sweet as pie at dinner with Mrs. Hanlon's name, Taylor Page's character. What's her first name?
That is a good question. I don't have it in front of me.
Blanking on it.
Yeah.
But he's is it Charlotte? I think
could be.
Yeah. Anyway, he's sweet as could be around her, and then when she goes in the other room, he's like, he actually does not like Leroy.
Mm.
And they have a kind of tension between them. And Chris talked about this. He used some terms I wouldn't use because I'm not a person of color, but he said he used some slurs that in our interview that he was like, this is what, like Halloran looks down at Leroy because he sees him as a climber, as a guy who sucks up to the white establishment and the powers that be, and almost like a sellout, you know? And I thought, that's really interesting. You're right. These guys are not, they're not bros. They're not buddies until Leroy has that moment on the porch where he indicates that he can tell that Halloran's doing something. He can kind of read him.
Yeah.
And that tells Halloran, like, okay, this guy can see me just like Pennywise can see me. Like, you can see me. You know what I'm up to. Usually I'm operating in the shadows. I'm a bit invisible.
Yeah.
But he sees him, and then suddenly that changes the dynamic between them.
Yeah.
So what did you think of that?
He's seen twice. Yeah, no, for sure. This is definitely the episode where Dick gets the rug pulled out from under him by an interdimensional creature and by Leroy Hanlon. He is, and Hanlon points out that he correctly identifies him as being part of the attack that happened to him on the first night, the test.
That's it. That's the moment. And he's like, I know it was you.
Because he's like, I think the way he puts it is, he's like, I can feel, he can somehow feel Halloran probing him, right? Mm-hmm. And he's like, I felt that same thing that night, which is very interesting. And it's also interesting, I got to say, I love the family dynamic between, in the Hanlon household, because you have two, what on the surface look like, opposite people. You have the hell-raising, I'm going to make change through confrontation side with his mm-hmm. wife, and then you have his side, which is more of a I'm going to affect change from inside. This is how you get real change, is you grow in power in the established institution. And her, they talk a lot about, we had to move because of you and the ruckus you were making. And that, I mean, that goes down, we've had political talks before, where I think we're both on the same, same side, but we both, it's the whole MLK Malcolm X thing. It's like, which is the more effective
tactics.
Way?
Yeah.
What's the way? And I love that, that there's obviously love there, but there's also that rub between them too. you know, where...
But you're talking about between Charlotte between and Charlotte and Leroy.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it is Charlotte, by the way. I'm good. Sure of that.
And to your point, I think Halloran picks up on that, too, and he addresses them both differently, and I think that he's way more on her side. It's like, you're making, you know, good trouble, right? That's kind of the feeling that you get, so...
Yeah, and Chris told me, he goes, you know, Halloran is judging Leroy, but what he's not seeing is that he's doing the same thing.
Mm, right.
He just thinks because he has a special power that he's apart from it, right. You know, but he realizes Halloran's trying to climb up the ladder and he's appealing to the white general, you know, he's asking for this hangout spot. He realizes by the end, oh, I'm doing the same thing that Leroy's doing. I'm just approaching it from a different direction. And I think being seen, being exposed a little bit makes him go, actually, okay, I do have this power, but I'm not invincible. I'm not on a different level from everybody else. I'm kind of just in the mix, too.
Right.
So I think, I think this is good writing because there's stuff to think about, ways to perceive the characters. I think the simple way would be for Halloran and Leroy Hanlon to see each other and immediately be like, okay, we're a team now,
right,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
And instead, no, they're not. They got to figure out there, and I think that makes the relationship stronger and more interesting.
I agree
that they choose to be friends rather than automatically become friends because they share some, you know, exterior similarities.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that shows a depth to the characters.
Well, and color me surprised that this would have been my favorite subplot of this episode, because, you know, I grew up with the book. I love, you know, kids fighting monsters, so I would have thought that the kids line, because I've liked that as probably my favorite, you know, part of the multiple threads up till this episode. But to me, you're right, this the Halloran stuff to me and this one is the strongest. But we should probably talk about the other two threads. We have Ronnie's father Hank in prison or in jail. He's in jail, and you get a little bit more of his alibi maybe not holding water here. He's kind of trapped a little bit with a mention of the cigarettes that he likes to smoke that were found at a certain spot.
That was clever police work by Chief Bowers, gotta say. He offers him Pall Mall cigarettes, and Hank is like, oh yeah, it's not really my brand. He goes, oh really, I would have thought you were. And he goes, no, like, I'm an Embassy Gold guy. And of course they find Embassy Gold cigarettes at the scene, and like just the way he sets him up, and you can see something in that actor's eyes where it's sort of like, oh, you felt like it, again. We talked about this last episode. Bowers isn't just like a hard charging racist.
Right.
He might be racist deep down, but he's not trying to railroad this guy. He is trying to determine whether he actually did it or not. And this is a little test that Hank fails in a way. He's lying, right? He says he wasn't there, and now he fell into the trap with the cigarettes. Like, I'm like, that's some pretty good police work there, Bowers. But even though it is leading him astray, it's not leading him toward the answer we know to be true. It does make sense that he would believe that circumstantially.
For sure. Yeah. So what's his, I mean, we know what happened, you know, that that a evil mutant demon baby flew out of the Music Man and ripped apart some kids.
Not necessarily Occam's razor there. That's not the conclusion that you would the simplest explanation.
But you know, but his alibi of I was at home all night is getting torn to shreds. Apparently there's an eyewitness that puts him at a location that he then kind of confirms by having a cigarette brand be at that location, you know, crumpled up. But if he wasn't a litter bug, he would have been totally fine. So there's definitely stuff brewing, and that all plays into the kids' storyline. I mean, the investigation into Ronnie's dad is the most minor part of this episode. It's, you know, it gets a couple of scenes, but it mostly plays into Lily coming back from her stint at Juniper Hill after the pickle incident, and trying to make good with Ronnie by helping exonerate her father, right? And something that I wanted to point out here that's very interesting is that Juniper Hill's been brought up as this incredible hellhole. Like, she doesn't want to go back. It was torture. It was nightmarish. But we, the first scene we see of her as she's leaving is she's has this very warm-hearted conversation with the head of housekeeping, who we're told through the administrator, Lily's made a connection to. And there's something interesting about this, because if you notice the housekeeper, this kindly woman, the one of the last things she does is give her back her charm bracelet, which has, again, the turtle that was gifted to her, right, by the now dead boy from the beginning of the first episode of the season. And it makes me wonder, especially the scene is brightly lit, like, do you think that this housekeeper, this the head of housekeeping at Juniper Hill, do you think she's an agent of the white, as they would say in Dark Tower, or do you think that, you know, it's just a kindly person that happens to be around there?
I like that theory. It's interesting. I'm not going to react too much to it because, again, I've watched a little further down the road. So I don't want to confirm or negate, but I think you're on an interesting path there.
And I think, based on what we've talked about a little bit earlier, I think I may be starting to connect some dots here.
Well, it's played by the actor is Madeline Stowe.
Oh, I didn't even clock that. Yeah.
Yeah, who, you know, it's been a while since I've... I know she's continued to work over the years, but she's, you know, she's a fabulous actress. You don't cast Madeline Stowe for a throwaway part, and I think we're going to see more of that housekeeper. And I think, yes, she... is she an agent of the white? Like, I guess it depends on what you consider the light, right? So that's... interesting. But you're on an interesting path.
Interesting.
She's definitely somebody you want to keep your eye on. And I think yeah, it's fair to say it's Madeline Stowe, and she's cast in the series. So we're going to see that character
interesting.
Again.
Okay.
We're going to learn more about her. But what is she doing there? She's taking care of these mentally unwell people.
Right.
She's trying to provide some comfort in a place that really isn't very comfortable. Even if it did look okay, you know, she was checking out.
Right.
But I'm sure the dark nights there and the loneliness of a kid in a mental asylum in the early 1960s, like, that is has got to be upsetting and terrifying. Right. I've had friends who, you know, they've had their struggles and as teenagers had to go to not a place like that, but a place where people are helped who have mental problems. And, they, you know, one of the stories I heard from a friend of mine is, yeah, you hear people like shouting. And one of the most terrifying things, you're struggling with your own depression or anxiety or struggles with perception. And then there's somebody like shouting absolute gibberish down the hall. Like, it gets in your head in some ways. I think this is a scene from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest where they kind of work, the patients at the hospital work each other up into a frenzy.
Yeah.
And I think that Madeline Stowe's character is, she's there providing aid and comfort to people who are in that situation. So yeah, I think, yeah, you, I could see where you're making the connection between light and dark.
Yeah.
And she does provide, she does give her that charm bracelet back and says, you'll need this. So maybe she's clued into something. Maybe maybe it's the light. Maybe it's the turtle working through her, taking an active, a rare active role. I don't know.
Could be.
Interesting to see.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, and I clocked it mostly, again, with the charm thing. Maybe I'm putting too much emphasis on that, but with the turtle representing the good and it being such a high focus from the very first episode, you know, it, it seems to me that, that's some sort of talisman for Lily.
For sure.
And I think the fact that it is given to her by this character, again, leads me to trust her. Maybe that's not a trust that's well-earned, but... so you have Lily and you have Ronnie reconnecting. Ronnie's, you know, of course, upset. Still blames Lily for her father getting arrested because she changed her testimony slightly to open the door to there being the possibility that her dad was there, and that's just what the police needed to lock him up. And their theory, which I've, you know, what they want to do, like, okay, we're going to make good. I'm going to help, and this is what we're going to do about it. I fucking love it because it is such kid logic. all we got to do is take a picture of this evil thing that's around there. And then everybody will believe us. And all we got to do is get proof. And so it becomes a mission. And they, you know, they bring in like the little boy that has the crush on Marge, you know, Lily's friend that's falling in with the popular kids.
This is Richie. Yeah, Rich. Rich, right? Not Richie. That's a different guy. But his name's Rich, right? Yeah. Isn't his name Richard or something?
I don't remember, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His name is Rich, but he's got Spanish heritage.
He's a Cuban, Cuban American.
Cuban,
yeah.
So he brings some knowledge of his own culture's ways of mediating with the afterlife.
Yeah.
Let's say, like, it's not quite a séance, but it is a sort of ritualistic, almost like a voodoo type ceremony, isn't it?
It is
an island type. Practice.
Right, and it's very kid logic. You know, it's just like, I've heard this, so we're going to go into the graveyard and light some candles and be ready with our camera. And I love the group dynamic you have here, where it's like, we're going to trust in you because you sound like you know what you're talking about from the adults in your life, who we come to find out later, by the way. He's like, well, I actually heard it from my cousin, and he heard it from, you know,
his father,
and he doesn't really know either, which, again, is very kid-like thing, where I heard it offhand, so that means I'm an expert in it. But you have, you know, the two girls that are one trying to prove she's not insane, to the other one's trying to exonerate her father. And then you have Will Hanlon in there, who is the non-believer. He is the guy that it's just like, you know, I like my friends, and you are becoming my friends, and I like you people. And I think, you know, it's kind of established he's got a crush on Ronnie, and, you know, he's got like, he's part of this group, but he is the scientific guy. He's the bookworm. He's the, you know, he's almost the more of the Stan Uris, right? Where he's like, this isn't practical. This is how world works, right? And so, again, I love this dynamic. So as much as I, you know, was saying that the kid stuff's my least favorite in this, it absolutely isn't. But, like, I just think it gets outshined by the Dick Hanlon segment. But I do love the adventure that they go on. And then they lose me a little bit. There were some of the dodgiest effects, I think, in the whole series so far happens in this graveyard confrontation with the entity, which doesn't really, you know, the little Cuban voodoo stuff that he's thinking doesn't really work, but it's enough that they're in the right spot at the right time, and then they attract it. And
His name is Rich, by the way. It's played by Arian S. Cartaya.
Okay.
But yeah, Rich comes up with this cockamamie theory of half-heard legends, and they have their seance.
Right.
They've got the camera. And you're right. This is... I feel like this is a quarrel I have with this episode. I think that it becomes a kind of Goosebumps-type finale where they're
Scooby-Doo,
riding through.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah, where they're riding through, and a little too much of, like, we lost the camera, we got the camera back. Like, I didn't really care for that very much. And, you know, look, most of this is very cinematic. It looks great for the most part. This, I don't know if it just was the challenge, like, how do you film kids riding on bikes at night through a graveyard in a way that's safe? And it's obvious that they're using green screen or blue screen or something.
It looks just real bad. It looks like 1950s, like, black and white rear screen projection when, like, the detective is, like, driving, and there's like an eighth generation grainy fucking projection behind him.
Remember in the Naked Gun? Remember in the Naked Gun when he would be driving, or like in the Police Squad TV series?
In an airplane.
Airplane.
Yeah.
Where they're just driving, and it's like obvious, it's just a movie playing behind them. Yep. It's so obvious. It's not like, you know, that's what it kind of reminded me of. I really wish they had taken more care with this part, because it really threw me out once, and I just thought the game of, you know, capture the flag with a camera was not necessary. Just get out of that graveyard.
Right.
Like, it was cool that they were seeing the ghosts of their friends that were torn up in the movie theater. I like that part of it. I didn't think the ghost effects were that believable. Again, it looked like Ghostbusters. And I love Ghostbusters, but, like, the ghosts in Ghostbusters are meant to be kind of funny, like right. they like the library ghost and Slimer and all that. And this just felt a little like I don't know. It wasn't all that spooky to me. It looked a little too Mr. Boogity Halloween right. special on ABC in 1992.
It was cartoony. Yeah. I mean, I'll say this. At least there's a little personality. There's kind of a deadite personality to the ghost children mm-hmm. that I liked. Yeah. And I wish that they just wouldn't, like, use the Goosebumps is a perfect thing. It's like, we don't want Goosebumps in our It. We don't want to mix in that R.L. Stine in there. No. I'm sorry. But
think about how scary the Glick boys visiting the window right. in Salem's Lot was right. back in the 1979 version. Right, not right. even any of the new remakes, but just that pale face out in the dark shadows. Like, it's so effective that I wish they had just gone. I wish they had made it a little more simple. Right. You know? And anyway, they end up back at the school processing the film, and surprise, surprise, they've captured it on camera. They've captured the ghosts on yeah. camera, which are a manifestation of it. And then they capture this grainy pseudo shape of a clown
right.
with the deadlight eyes. Yeah. And then we'll see what this evidence brings them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it ends with the words, "It's a clown," right? And then you see yeah. the very well-known shape. Which I like, because I think the instinct for a lot of this stuff is like, oh, we're going to get proof, and then like, oh, it doesn't show up on camera. We already know that's bullshit because it's been, you know, photographed before, and it doesn't care. And that's one of the things I like about it, right? It's like, especially in the Pennywise form, it doesn't give a fuck. Like, it'll pop up in charcoal drawings. It'll pop up in photos going back to the turn of the century. And it's like, it doesn't really care. It doesn't really matter. You know, for this thing. And that's part of what makes it scary. It's like, it doesn't, like, oh no, you got me. You got proof that I'm around. Who gives a fuck? You know, like, I'm ultimately powerful, you know, here in this
situation. It goes back to what I was saying, that it decides when it gets seen.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a little of Andy Muschietti's cameo, right? Like, those old photos, and you're right, all those charcoal drawings of, from the late 1800s, 1900, mm-hmm. early 1900s, is Pennywise wants you to see him every now and then. Yeah. He wants to make his mark. He wants to be the director who gets a cameo and a line, you know, and do the Hitchcock thing of walking by with a couple of dogs, right. you know, in the background. Pennywise doesn't want you to have control over him. And when you see someone, meaning in the true sense, like, you see when you know who someone is, you have a measure of control. That's why Halloran is so disturbed,
right.
seen by it and seen by Leroy. When you decide how people see you, that is right. that is power. And I think Pennywise likes to be seen, and these photographs capture Pennywise. So I'm thinking Pennywise wanted to appear on film.
Yeah,
Pennywise was like, essentially, like, let me pose for you a little bit.
There might be a reason that it changed forms mm-hmm. in the crypt and let Mike Hanlon, you know, it could have been anything. It had been dead kids up until that point. Why change to the mm-hmm. clown, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's not its natural form, so it's a choice. It's yeah. a costume change, you know? And like Taylor Swift and Beyonce, Pennywise knows the power of a costume change.
And that's the headline of this episode. Pennywise knows the power of a concept change, or costume change. One final thing that I want to bring up before mm-hmm. we wrap out here, and you tell me if I'm stretching too much on this. This might be a little right. too Stephen King nerdy, but something that stuck out to me for this finale, we're seeing the three dead kids, right? You had mm-hmm. the kind of the new Richie Tozer. We had... what Stan's uncle or whatever that would have yeah. been. And then you have the little girl, the sister, I think, of the older kid, the Richie kid, mm-hmm. right? And I'm like, so you have those three spirits, and I'm like, there's four people in this group. The original losers are seven, and they make a big point that there's power in seven in the It book. Mm-hmm. That's why when they finally defeat it, they have to represent the two missing members, like the dead Stan and Mike in the hospital, mm-hmm. right? So that in order to defeat this, there's something in, again, this is the power of the white. There's some power in seven. So with the three dead kids and the four main kids, do you think that that was the intended group that was supposed to stand up to Pennywise in this cycle, and three of them got taken out instantly and then ultimately doomed this? What do you think? Is that too much of a nerdy Stephen King reach?
I think that's pretty true. So what we have among the living is we've got Will Hanlon, we've got Rich, the kid from Cuba.
Right.
We've got Ronnie, the daughter of the projectionist.
Yeah.
We've got Lily, the girl with the...
the pickled father.
Mental health problems. Pickled father. So that's four.
Yeah.
There are other kids at school. Do we think Margie, the girl with the glasses, is going to be a part of this quartet?
No. No. I mean, if she was, then that throws off my theory, so I don't like it. I think that it, you know, the first three were kind of set up as the default group, and they all kind of converge together for the finale of that first episode. So it'd be like, to me, this is what if the losers, as we knew them, you know, in the 80s version in the Muschietti universe, right? If three of them had died on their first encounter with Pennywise, like at the Niebolt house. You know.
Well, one thing to consider as a thought experiment,
and
I haven't seen all the way through, so I'm not sure how this will be a part of it, if it will be a part of it.
Right.
But what is time to Pennywise?
Right.
Is a question I think it's worth asking. And I'm asking that not as a tease, but as a real question.
Right.
Like, he's infinite. When you're infinite, is time linear? Or are you looking at the whole picture, you know, in the way that Kurt Vonnegut talked about his what are those aliens? The Tralfamagorians?
Right.
Like they exist sort of like they know when everything has happened. They're sort of aware that they're on a continuum and they know what comes before and they know what comes after. And I wonder if, like, Pennywise is that way, too, if he's all-knowing in that sense of, like, I know what's ahead for me, and I can anticipate it. Maybe he just detects patterns, right? But he's good at anticipating where people are going to be, what they're going to do. He's good at reading them.
Right.
And if you're good at reading somebody, you're good at anticipating what their next move will be. So, yeah, I think maybe he sees these kids forming a group and knows there's something about that. I'm getting a tingle, a little Peter tingle from a little spider sense, literally the spider in the sewers. Maybe his spider sense is tingling and is like, I gotta break up this group somehow. So it's interesting. Maybe. But I also am curious whether other kids will join the group.
That's true.
As we move forward.
Yeah, that could happen, you know, and I'm also curious as we progress into season two and three, if we're going to see a similar, you know, seven children as the core group. I mean, ultimately, we know that the seven kids that defeated them as adults, and they weren't a full group either. But yeah, I don't know. Again, just going back to the text, because King goes out of his way in the It book to talk about the power of seven, that there's power to that number. And so it might be coincidence, but it just struck me watching those twitchy goosebumps ghosts, you know, flying after these guys. I'm like, well, oh, shit, if we actually add those to the existing kids, if that was our seven, our core group, then essentially, you know, for this cycle of the entity, if there is supposed to be seven that can stand a chance at defeating it, they've already lost this one, right? And maybe. So I don't know.
Well, we know that they aren't going to kill it.
That's
know
true.
We know that it's a losing battle in some ways, but
right.
Exactly how it goes down is going to be interesting.
Right. Well, I guess that's why we have a continuing weekly series to look at. We'll find more answers
next week.
Well, thanks, Brez. This has been a lot of fun. I love digging into this stuff with you.
Yeah,
and
you too.
And I guess thanks to everybody for watching or listening along, and we'll see y'all next week as we watch It, Welcome to Derry, Episode 4.